Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimension Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, a writer and analyst at MLB.com. Today is Wednesday, September 1st. It is roster expansion day, so we're going to do the same here. We've expanded our roster to welcome in Sarah Langs, one of our favorites from MLB.com. Matt is on vacation. We'll have Sarah instead. And Sarah, I promise you, in a little bit, we're going to get to a Juan Soto topic, and I didn't do that specifically because you're on the show with us today, but there's maybe one person on this planet who likes Juan Soto more than me, and it's you. So I think this is going to be perfect timing. I hope you're excited to talk about Juan Soto.
I am always excited to talk about Juan Soto, and thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here to fill in, and it worked out very perfectly that you had this awesome Juan Soto story you're working on, and here we are today hosting the podcast.
On today's show, we are going to talk about the Rays, who are having what I would consider to be their best year ever. We are going to get to Juan Soto. We're going to talk about Brandon Crawford, and should he be in the National League MVP consideration, how the Phillies are doing, like the weirdest thing that's happening. I can't wait to talk about the Phillies lineup. And then Sarah and I will each choose a player to highlight and have a little bit of a rant and rave. We have to start with the Rays. Tampa Bay, like obviously I know Tampa Bay has been very good. They've been in first place, right? They won 9 in a row, which I don't think I had been paying close enough attention to. They are the first team since the 2002 Moneyball A's to have two different calendar months with at least 21 wins in the same season. They went 22-6 in May. They have 21 wins. They had 21 wins in August. They are on pace to win 102 games. They have the American League's best record for 26 games in a row. And this is the thing I think that stands out to me the most. You think about the Rays and you think about pitching. They've scored the most runs in baseball at 7-10. How much of what the Rays are doing is surprising you in the sense that everybody, you know, I mean, they went to the World Series last year, right? But everybody crushed them for trading away Snell and not retaining Charlie Morton. And here they are again. And is next year the year we don't underrate the Rays, or is this just kind of the way this is going to be?
It feels like maybe this is just how it's going to go from now on. But, you know, what really stands out to me is that at a certain point in the season, I want to say about a month ago, the narrative with the Rays was that they had that really great May, which you referred to, when they had the 21-plus wins, one of the two months where they had the 22 wins. And other than that, there was kind of this narrative that, okay, they'd sort of been 500 other than that. I think I called a Rays game just about a month ago, and that was actually a research note we had, was that they were, at that point, 500 in every other month, and they had this outstanding May. But clearly they have changed the narrative there. They've been playing really well, especially as the Red Sox kind of started to surge back and now are going in the opposite direction, not just because of on-field stuff, some of that being COVID issues that they're dealing with. But the offense is not what we expected from this team. And I think that we have to highlight Wander Franco here. I mean, when they first called him up, the entire thing that everybody was saying was that you cannot expect a 20-year-old to fix your offense, and that they weren't expecting him to, that they knew it was time to bring him up, and that they weren't expecting him to save the season necessarily, but they were hoping to get great contributions from him. And now he has a 31 game on base streak. He is among the longest on base streaks for anybody as young as him. Again, he is 20 years old. And the offense has been clicking in that span over this last month plus.
We talked about this on base streak for Franco last week. And I was like, this is super interesting and cool. And it probably can't last that much longer. And here we are a week later. And as you said, 31 games for Franco. And the interesting thing to me about the Rays offense is, so they traded for Nelson Cruz, and Cruz hasn't actually done that much for them. You know, 262 on base, and he has 7 homers is good, but he's been a below average hitter, and that was a move that I thought was going to be fantastic. It was going to work out perfectly, and it's been okay, but you look up and down the lineup, and it's sort of like depth, I guess. Like Mike Zunino, I know he's hitting 206, but he's going to have a 30 home run season, right? Arozarena has not been the guy who's been in the playoffs. He's probably going to win Rookie of the Year, unless Franco does. Is Franco going to win Rookie of the Year? Can he still do that?
I mean, we were talking about this yesterday. You were tweeting about, you know, the latest debut date. The answer is Willie McCovey, who debuted on July 30th, the year that he won Rookie of the Year. He had the fewest games. He played in 48 games and won Rookie of the Year. But I do think that, you know, narrative often plays a role in how these awards are decided, and maybe a little bit less so with Rookie of the Year than with some of the other BBWA awards. But I think that if he carries this on base streak, I mean, the record on that list of guys 20 and under is Frank Robinson with 43 games. That suddenly does feel in reach for Wander Franco. If he breaks a record and this team cruises into the playoffs the way it looks like they're going to, I mean, I think I would be voting for him if I had a pick.
I'm going to play a game. I can't play it with you because you're too good at this, but I'm going to play it with the listeners, right? I'm going to name 14 pitchers on the Rays roster, and three of these names are made up, okay? And I want everybody listening to pick which three of these names are made up. Here's 14 names: JP Fireisen, Andrew Kittredge, Shane McClanahan, Colin McHugh, Luis Patino, Drew Rasmussen, Michael Wacha, Chris Archer, Sean Armstrong, JT Chagua, Adam Conley, Dietrich Enns, Pete Fairbanks, and Ryan Yarbrough. Which three of those names are made up? Here's the trick: none of them are made up. That is the current Tampa Bay Rays pitching staff. Only six of those guys were on the opening day roster, and one of those, Archer, has missed basically the whole season. He's only just come back now. Dietrich Enns, Adam Conley, Sean Armstrong. I'm not going to do this because I think this would be tedious podcasting, but I would be curious to know if even you, Sarah, could tell me how they got all of those guys.
Oh, gosh.
I was like, Adam Conley, I remember him from like the Christian Yelich era Miami Marlins.
Yep.
He's back somehow. Because you think about the guys who had been the heroes of this pitching staff. Nick Anderson, who's been out all year, is coming back soon, I think. He hasn't pitched all year. They traded Diego Castillo to Seattle in a move, yep, I didn't totally understand at the time. And, you know, Tyler Glasnow obviously has been injured, injured his elbow. He's going to miss much of next year. And you just think about, like, they don't have the guys you'd expect, and yet it never seems to matter. Like, they keep turning, you know, Drew Rasmussen was one of the guys that got back from Milwaukee in the Willy Adames trade, and he's been doing some starting for them. Andrew Kittredge made the All-Star team. The fact that they just kind of, like, keep coming up with players out of absolutely nowhere. Remember, it used to be Chaz Rowe. It used to be Oliver Drake and Nick Anderson and Diego Castillo and Jose Alvarado, and it ends up not mattering. And I guess that's maybe an unpopular way to play baseball, but it's working for them. All right, we are going to take a quick break, and we will be back to our pre-batter room.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We are back on the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. I know it's okay if no one's been paying attention to the Nationals lately because they traded away almost all their roster, and they've been pretty rough to watch in August. And yet Juan Soto still exists, and I just don't think it's possible at all to overhype Juan Soto. As I said earlier, I'm so thankful to have Sarah with us because, Sarah, I know you want Juan Soto. Is Juan Soto your favorite baseball player right now? Like, you have such great talent. We've got Tatis and Acuna and Vlad. But is Juan Soto number one for you?
I think he is. I mean, I had a former colleague who used to joke that in the days of the 25-man roster that I had 750 favorite players, which would be everybody on the active roster. And now we have to up that with 26-man, and it's 28-man rosters as of today. But certainly there is a big tie kind of towards the top there. But lately, it really does feel like it's Juan Soto. And after the conversation that you and I and Vince Gennaro had with Brian Kenny about Juan Soto on our MLB Network Top 10 right now, we were talking about right fielders. We all ranked him number one. And Brian Kenny had Mookie Betts number one out in right field. I think that just that conversation and the entire offseason really cemented it for me.
Oh, I forgot about that. And then when you started telling that story, I was like, oh, God, I hope I had him pretty high. I hope I said nice things about Juan Soto. So you could come up, I think, probably with 100 million different interesting things to talk about Juan Soto. This is not the point of the story, but it was something I noticed. So they made all these trades at the deadline. And if you look at the Dodgers trade, the one that sent Scherzer and Trey Turner out west, the Dodgers got three. They sent back four prospects, and one of them is not really a huge prospect, but three of them were in the top 30 of the Dodgers list, right? Gerardo Carrillo, Josiah Gray, and K-Bear Ruiz. All three of them are older than Juan Soto is right now, which is just the dumbest thing. But here's the point of this. Juan Soto just walked 30.3% of the time in August. He stepped to the plate 109 times. He walked 33 times. Nobody else in baseball walked even 20% of the time. That is like the dumbest thing. That's such a gap. Joey Gallo, 19.1% was in second. So what I did is I looked back over the last century of baseball, back to the start of the live ball era in 1920, the American League and the National League. And you look for every single month where anybody stepped to the plate 100 times. And I wanted to know who walked more than 30% in a month. You'll be unsurprised to know Barry Bonds did this 11 different times because, you know, those are not all, but many of them were intentional walks. Ted Williams did it once. Votto and Ruth did it once. Jack Clark did it once. John Bayberry and Juan Soto. He walked 30.3% of the time. He has one of the 10 highest walk rates for a career in baseball history. Now, here's the part that I was surprised to find. Because I think if you tell most people, okay, hey, Juan Soto just walked an insane amount of time in August, what did the Nationals do at the trade deadline? They traded away pretty much every competent hitter in their lineup, right? Turner is gone, and Schwarber is gone, and Josh Harrison's gone, and Yan Gomes is gone. And so you might think to yourself, oh, well, if I'm a pitcher, why on earth am I pitching to Juan Soto? And I was shocked to find that's not really what's happening. Like, it's happening a little bit, obviously, but he's still got Josh Bell behind him, and it's not that. He's not seeing that many fewer pitches in the strike zone. It's like 45% down from 51% earlier in the year, whatever it was. He's not swinging anymore. Nope. He is just like, is he being too passive? I think this was like a Joey Votto problem for a while. People wanted him to expand the zone and, you know, put his dangerous bat on the ball. But part of what makes him dangerous is only swinging at the pitches he can do damage on. You know, like there's that push and pull here. And I was surprised to find it's not just that pitches were like, well, I'm not throwing you a strike ever, because that's not what's happening.
He just doesn't swing. I mean, and I don't want him to expand the zone. I don't want him to do anything else. I mean, one of my favorite sort of just like compilations of Soto stats, and it's essentially what you just said, was a couple of weeks ago, I was just digging on his Savant page, as I do. And he has, as we know, the lowest swing rate in the majors, is lower than even Max Muncy, who's kind of the, you know, popular no swing guy these days. He has the lowest chase rate, which, you know, goes hand in hand with that. And then he also has the highest percentage of swings in baseball producing hard contact. So 95 plus mile an hour exit velocity. That to me is the perfect hitter. So he doesn't swing very much, but when he does, he makes hard contact more than anybody else per swing. I just think that that's exactly what he is doing, and he knows that he's doing it. I mean, I actually sent this to you the other day, but he had this amazing quote a couple days ago after one of the games. He was asked about all of the walks, and I'm sure that all the beat writers were kind of starting to notice that crazy walk rate that you noticed in August. And he said this was on leading the league in walks. Whenever they want to play, I play. When they don't want to play, I just take my walk. And so maybe that is giving a little bit more credit to not seeing pitches in the zone, which, as you're saying, is not fully what's going on. But I think in his mind, when they want to play is that meatball down the middle. So he'll just wait for that because it will come at some point. I mean, we saw him become the first lefty to take Aaron Loop deep in like 4 years the other day against the Mets. And he continues to do things like that, hit home runs that make even visiting broadcasters just completely unaware of how he did it.
He is the perfect hitter. And I think people get frustrated a little bit where it's like, hey, this guy's 22. We're comparing him with like the all-time legends of the game. And I get it. But look at this list. So if you look at every hitter through age 22 in baseball history, back to 1901 in American League and National League history, and you sort them by walk rate, he is second on a list. Here's number one, Ted Williams, who ended up hitting 500 home runs. Number three is Eddie Matthews, 500 home runs. Jimmy Fox, 500 home runs. Mel Ott, 500 home runs. Mickey Mantle, 500 home runs. And number seven, just Ricky Henderson. No big deal. Like, these are the names he's with. So whenever anybody's like, oh, it's too much too soon, I argue it is not.
No.
It's not enough. And I know there's no one who agrees with me on that more than you do. Okay, number two. Here's our second one. We are going to get into the Phillies in a minute, and that's going to inevitably talk about Bryce Harper. But first, I want to talk about Brandon Crawford and whether he is worthy of MVP consideration. I'm going to tell you why this came up. So obviously the Giants have been an incredible surprise, and we've talked about that many times about, you know, why, what's happening. And if you look at it, it's not just about acquiring these under-the-radar guys like Lamont Wade and Mike Yastrzemski, like it's that, but it's also about the veterans they had who seemed like they were maybe past their prime rebounding. And Crawford's a great example of this. From 27 to 2019, he had an 84 OPS plus, and then over the last 2 years, as he's age 33, 34, he's been fantastic. He's slugging almost 500. You know, he's been an incredible rebound guy. And so I thought this was interesting. This was tweeted to me, at me by Andrew Baggerly, who's a Giants beat writer for The Athletic. And he said, I get why he might not be an overwhelming favorite, but why is Brandon Crawford getting almost no recognition as a top five candidate in the NL MVP race? And I thought that was interesting. And I thought about it, and I don't think I'd have him in my top five. In my top 10, yes. But there's also a certain point where it's like, is there a difference between four and nine? Not really. You're splitting hairs. And I think anytime you talk about the MVP, there is one like philosophical thing you have to get past. Do you care about a team being in first place or not? I personally do not care. The Giants are up by, I think, 1.5 game right now. And if tomorrow they are down by 0.5 a game, does that change my opinion of Brandon Crawford? Like, not at all. You know, I would vote for Juan Soto. I'm not saying I would put him number one on my list, but I would consider him, even though the Nationals are terrible. How do you feel on that? I don't care about the first place thing at all.
Absolutely. I don't care at all. I mean, I think we all look at Mike Trout's career, and certainly people who value history and stats, whatever else you want to say, think that he should probably have a couple more MVP awards. And I think that a lot of that probably had to do with how the Angels were doing those years. So I certainly do not agree with that. And I agree. I mean, I think Juan Soto should have gotten consideration last year. I know that was a games played thing maybe, but I definitely think he would be on a ballot somewhere towards the top this year.
Yeah, you know who's going to win the American League MVP this year? Shohei Ohtani. The Angels Absolutely. Are terrible. But I thought it was an interesting conversation. You know, once you get past that whole thing, like, do you care where your MVP comes from? Because I thought Andrew's point was an interesting one in that we're not talking about Crawford at all, or at least I don't think we are. You know, we think about the NL MVP conversation, and to me, it has seemed like kind of a three-person race, right? Tatis, Muncy, and more recently, Harper. And I think you can make an argument for Trey Turner, even though no MVP has ever been traded midseason. I know Pirates fans would love me to say Brian Reynolds, but I'm sorry, it's not going to be Brian Reynolds. And I think Crawford's interesting because the Giants have been such a cool story this year, and you could make a pretty strong case, I think, that he's been their best player, right? Like, Posey's missed a lot of time, and then their strength has been more about depth, I think, than superstars. You know, like, they've got quality at-bats everywhere, but they don't have a Juan Soto, you know, or a Fernando Tatis Jr. And Crawford is such like a great encapsulation of how they've gotten here. Like, they've just made players better. They've made players better than they were. This team's for real. Like, I don't know if they're going to win the division, but they're definitely making it to the wild card. And so I respect the argument. Like, I think simultaneously Crawford is not in my top three or top five, but also that Andrew is right and that we should be talking about him more, right? Because I don't know about you, but it sure felt to me like he was cooked. Going into 2020 yep. or so, I was surprised he was still their shortstop, to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that while I personally, if I were voting, don't consider where a team is, I do think that when I look for candidates, just guys we should be talking about in an MVP race, I do tend to, beyond the absolute standout players, regardless of team, the guys like Soto, you know, Tatis, even if the Padres were to miss the playoffs, I think beyond that, I do sort of look at the standings and I say, okay, who's the best player on this team? Who is the guy who is carrying this team? And I think people were talking about Joey Votto for a while just simply because of the Reds' comeback and the fact that they might end up being that second wild card. And I think that was fair. And I do think that tying that to the fact that the team had this miraculous turnaround, I am okay with that more so than the flip side of penalizing a guy for his team being bad. But I have absolutely loved watching this Brandon Crawford turnaround. I agree. I mean, I was surprised that he was necessarily still that starting shortstop, and it really looked like his career was over. I mean, he had been a great prospect for them. He had, you know, come from UCLA, everything else, and it just seemed like he was going to be this light-hitting shortstop. He'd had that one year where he kind of had, prior to this point, a career year hitting-wise, and that was a year that he was reported, or I think known, to have worked with Barry Bonds in spring training, and a lot of that was credited to him. It was in 2015. He hit 21 home runs. He showed this prodigious power that he had never shown before. But then you get to this year, and he's slugging 509. And I actually was spending some time with my mother a couple weeks ago. She is a big Giants fan. And she asked me, has a guy ever had a career year like this? Like absolute career year at this age? He's 34 years old. And obviously, we've seen plenty of guys be good at that age, but most of them had already had a good year at some point. So that's kind of the distinction. So I ended up finding this pretty fun note with the Elias Sports Bureau. So he's slugging 509, as I mentioned. He entered 2021 with a 392 career slugging percentage. So there have only been three players in AL or NL history to slug 500 or better in a season at age 34 or older after entering the year with a career slugging percentage under 400. So I know that sounds kind of qualifiery, but I wanted to encapsulate this concept of an absolute career year that we had never seen before. So those other guys to do this, and Crawford will join them if he does slug 500 for the year, were Brett Gardner in 2019. He slugged 503. He entered at 390. Louis Polonia in 1999 slugged 526. He entered at 370. And Jerry Mumphrey in 1987 slugged 534 and he entered at 390. So I think it's really impressive that Crawford is doing all of this. And by the way, the team has been outstanding. I was so excited to see him get that contract extension because I just thought that it's really cool to see Farhan Zaidi giving credit to one of these guys who was there long before he was and for this career year. And as you mentioned, with the way you split the stats, I mean, this did kind of start last year. So it's great to see him continue to build on it.
You know what I just remembered? I'd forgotten about this until you were kind of talking about him right there. You grew up a Giants fan, and I grew up a Dodger fan, and there's a pretty big series this weekend. And
there
as much as I enjoy your company, I don't know if we're going to be able to be friends for the next couple of days. Okay, let's move on to our third topic here, and I'm very excited about this because it's so weird and so silly. Okay, I had written off the Phillies. I mean, let's be honest. Four or five different times over the course of this year. And then if you look at the last week or so of August, you look at what happened to their offense. On August 22nd, they demoted Alec Bohm to the minors, which I think took a lot of people by surprise. On August 26th, Rhys Hoskins, who had just come back off the injured list, had his season-ending surgery. On August 29th, JT Realmuto, who already had a sore shoulder, rolled his ankle, had to leave the game, and he has not been catching ever since. Also on August 29th, Didi Gregorius left the team for paternity leave. And congratulations to Mr. and Mrs. Gregorius. The offense should be totally cooked. And yet look what's happened. Over their last six games, they have scored at least seven runs in every single game. It is the first time since 1933 that the Phillies have scored seven runs in six consecutive games. I guess we should point out that those games have come against Arizona and Washington. Fine. But what is this lineup? Here's the lineup from last night. Freddy Galvis leading off, John Segura hitting second, Harper third, McCutchen fourth. Okay, that's fine. I don't love Galvis leading off, but, you know, Didi's not around. Fine. Number five, Jorge Bonifacio. Number six, Ronald Torres. Number seven, Matt Vierling. And number eight, Rafael Marchand. They had 12 runs last night. I guess we're going to have to get to Harper in a second, but can I first share with you two hilarious stats? Rafael Marchand had 1,074 plate appearances in the minors with zero home runs. He has now hit two in 50 major league plate appearances. And as you, Sarah, were able to look up for us, Jason Stark said he looked into this last year. He could not find any other active player with as many homerless minor league plate appearances as Marchand, who then hit his first pro home run in the big leagues.
Amazing.
Did you know who Matt Vierling was before, I don't know, this morning?
I saw him. I watched the game last night, so I learned who he was then. And by that, I mean I saw him in a Phillies uniform, and I said, oh, he's on the Phillies. That's all I know.
Matt Vierling last night made contact with five batted balls. Here were the exit velocities. 106, 105.6, 102.7, 104.5, 108.6. I could have just said he hit five balls at 102 miles an hour or more. He is one of just nine players since StatCast tracking came online in 2015 to hit a game, to have a game with five balls hit 102 miles an hour or more. And by the way, that list is pretty hilarious. There's real dudes like Soto's on there, Goldschmidt, Devers, Byron Buxton, right? Like, they're really good players. And also, Aaron Altair is on that list for some reason. He, Matt Vierling started the game at first base last night. He does not own a first baseman's mitt. He's an outfielder. He used Rhys Hoskins' glove. I don't want to like totally say Arizona and Washington have bad pitching staffs. I know that's part of it. But I'm not sure I can think of a better way to point out how weird and silly and unpredictable and random baseball is sometimes, that the Phillies could roll out this super janky lineup and just score runs endlessly for a week.
And this is a team that got swept by the Diamondbacks in Arizona like a week and a half ago. I mean, that was, you mentioned that you have written off the Phillies a couple different times this year. So have I. And that was one of them. That was, they had this huge comeback. They swept the Mets. They went into first place. Okay, the Phillies are going to win this division. And then they went on the road and they had that series. There may have been a series in between, but they looked pitiful in that series. I mean, Zach Wheeler said after the series, we should not be losing to a team like that. And I don't think he was trying to insult the Diamondbacks. We all know that they've had their trials and tribulations this season, but he was right. I mean, this was a team that was had designs on winning the division, had finally gotten into that point, and then this happened. So even to say that, oh, well, it was just against those teams, these were teams that the Phillies were not beating as recently as a couple weeks ago. So I think that that also makes it even more impressive because we've seen teams, I mean, we talk about spoilers all the time and it's September now, and that's certainly when we will throw that phrase around. And this happens. And I think that we've seen teams really lose out on chances to make the playoffs because of their play against teams like this. The Phillies had that the first year under Gabe Kapler. They had, I believe that if they had just gone like 500 against the Marlins, they probably would have made the playoffs. It was something like that. They won like three games against the Marlins all year. I guess that would have been 2018. And so this has been a thing. So I certainly don't write it off by who the opponents were, because this team had not shown an ability to beat those teams recently.
Here's the remaining schedule for the Phillies. They were supposed to play against Washington today, and I think that already got washed out, so that'll get made up. And then it's Miami, Milwaukee, Colorado, the Cubs, the Mets, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, Miami. Going to Milwaukee is a bad matchup for them. Going into Atlanta near the end of the season will not be easy, but otherwise, that's not that bad, right? And, you know, they're 2.5 games out of Atlanta, and I don't know what the current status is, but I saw last night that Ozzie Albies hit a ball off his leg and had to be helped off the field. Are there any updated status on him? Is he out? Is he available? Do you know?
They said that the x-rays were negative, but it did look very bad. I mean, I was glad to see that the x-rays were negative. I thought he might have shattered his kneecap, but it appears that did not happen. But certainly a concern for them.
Very good. Very good to hear, because I know they're already down without Acuna, and Albies is one of the more fun players in baseball. So the Phillies, you know, they're doing this a little bit through smoke and mirrors, I guess, because I don't trust that lineup, with the exception that Bryce Harper is amazing. Yes. He's been so good. He is slugging almost 600 right now, 306, 420, 594. Every time I tweet about him, someone says, well, he's only got 63 RBIs. It's like, come on, we know the answer to this. The Phillies lineup has not been good. They don't put anybody on base for him. And he has been better than ever lately. Do you know what he hit in August? 337, 455. He slugged 776. When I wrote, like, I don't know, 3 weeks ago that, you know, he was kind of coming up into the MVP conversation, I think people didn't totally buy it. And now it's like, well, Tatis hasn't been very good since he's come back. Muncy has been okay, but not as good as he was. Despite what we said earlier about not worrying too much about MVPs being in the playoffs, I sort of feel like if Harper wills like this team, which is not a very good team, into first place in the East, that actually will benefit him through some voters, I would think.
I agree. And I also think, I mean, the thing that I always bring up when we talk about, especially MVP, is that there's a difference between, and not against Harper, not to say that I don't think he should win, especially if he does that. But whenever we have these conversations, I see a distinction between who I think will win based on what we've seen with voting over the years and who maybe I think should win, right? Who I would vote for if I were voting. And I do think that if he does that with that team, there's a very strong argument. And I think that that's one that we've certainly seen borne out in plenty of voting lately. But I just think, you know, the entire Bryce Harper career path is so fascinating to me. And I really hope we get some sort of 30 for 30 about him 10 years after he's retired. I know that's not necessarily in line with his personality type that he would necessarily agree to that, but I hope that it could happen because it's just the highest of highs and some pretty down lows as well. When you look at that 2016, after he won the 2015 MVP award, but he just constantly gets compared to Mike Trout in some way. And it's because they came up on the same day, pretty much, was when Trout came up to the majors for good. And I just don't think it's fair. Nobody is Mike Trout. And I think that, you know, when I see people arguing against Bryce Harper for MVP, they bring up like Trout's career stats. And I just don't think that's a valid argument. And maybe I'm too far in the weeds of why people are trying to criticize a player, but he's having an outstanding season for a team that looks a lot more likely to win their division than they did even 24 hours ago. And I think that he does deserve a lot of credit for this. And I think he's going to finish top three for sure. And, you know, the Padres continue to fall out of it. We're talking about how much we care if a team is in the playoffs or not, but if Tatis continues to not be quite on that Tatis level over the course of time that the Padres fall out of it, that is going to hurt him in this, and I do think that's fair.
I think he's got a real shot at winning, and I think if the Phillies keep this up, that's only going to benefit him. All right, we will take a break, and we will be back to finish off our show with a pair of guys that you should know a little more about. Each week, Matt and I like to focus on some players maybe you don't know enough about. Matt is not here, so I'm really excited to see who Sarah is going to bring up. I'm going to start with Joe Ryan of the Minnesota Twins. Joe Ryan is making his major league debut against the Cubs tonight. And whenever I pick a guy I like to focus on, it's usually not because there's one interesting thing. It's because there's like three. And I think Joe Ryan definitely qualifies. He was a seventh rounder of the Rays in 2018, but he was traded to Minnesota just a couple weeks ago in the Nelson Cruz trade. And if you look at every pitcher who has at least 60 innings combined between AA and AAA this year, his 37% strikeout rate is sixth best of all of those. Now, you can't usually just scout that stat line and say he's going to be successful. However, some of the guys ahead of him include number one overall pitching prospect Grayson Rodriguez, Reed Detmers, who was the top pick of the Angels last year, and Shane Baz, who came over to Tampa Bay in the ill-fated Chris Archer trade. Now, what's interesting to me about Joe Ryan are multiple things here, partially because he doesn't throw that hard. He throws like 92, 93. We don't actually have any data on him yet, but like every scouting report says, you know, there's some rise to it. There's some deception. He throws from like a three quarters angle. And I was reading an interview with him where he kind of talked about why he throws from that angle. He has a water polo background. I cannot think of too many baseball players who have a background in water polo. Here's a quote from MLB Pipeline. Ryan believes that learning to finish his throws in water polo helped develop his bread and butter pitch. a swing and miss four-seam fastball that is played tremendously well at the top of the zone. Water polo in baseball. That's super cool. Here's the other thing. Look at the last 5 weeks of Joe Ryan's life. He was pitching in AAA for the Durham Bulls, the AAA affiliate of the Tampa Bay Rays. On July 18th, he made his last start for AAA Durham, and then he leaves for Tokyo because he was part of the U.S. Olympic team. He's there on July 22nd, actually in Tokyo time, July 23rd, 7 a.m. He's eating breakfast, and he finds out he's been traded to the Tampa Bay Rays, excuse me, from the Tampa Bay Rays to Minnesota. Well, he's not leaving to come back home. He stays with the Olympic team, wins a silver medal, gives up 2 runs in 10 and two-thirds innings, comes back to America, makes 2 starts for AAA for Minnesota, 17 strikeouts, 2 walks, and he starts tonight against the Cubs. And it's kind of important, I think, for the Twins, just because if you look at their starting rotation to start the year, all 5 guys are gone, hurt, traded, gone, whatever. And we're going to find out today the results of Kenta Maeda's elbow surgery. We don't know if it's a full Tommy John. We don't know if it's something more minor. But if it's Tommy John, he's missing all of 2022. And I don't know how to put together a Twins rotation for next year. And so they could really use Joe Ryan to be a big part.
I have a really fun follow-up Joe Ryan story, which is that I was watching a game on ESPN a couple weeks ago. It was a White Sox and Twins game. It was Dave Fleming and Jess Mendoza, and Jess had gotten to know Joe Ryan while she was out there for NBC covering the Olympics, and Joe Ryan actually FaceTimed into this game to do an interview from the, I want to say, Newark Airport during a layover as he was coming back. So that's when this was. It was like a couple of days after the Olympics ended. And he was such an engaging interview. I mean, I was really interested to hear everything he was saying. I mean, I'm always interested to hear what baseball players are saying. But he had a great personality. And so I think Twins fans, if you haven't heard from him yet, you should be excited for this player because as everything Mike just outlined, I think that he has potential to be really good for them. And he's also a really fun guy. So I would expect a lot of fun quotes from him pre, post game, anything like that. So it was pretty funny. He was just sitting there. He took out his medal sitting there, you know, wherever he was at some gate at the airport. And showing off, he had a backpack that he had traded with someone on the Japan baseball team. And he seemed to really enjoy that Olympic experience. But really, really fun interview from an airport, which I can't say I'd seen much on any baseball broadcast before.
I'm really glad you brought that up because I did a radio interview with the Minnesota radio yesterday and talked about Joe Ryan. And the host said, yeah, I interviewed Joe Ryan and he's like the greatest guy. Like I really enjoyed speaking to him, which backs up totally what you said. And I find it a lot easier to root for, you know, players on the field when it's also like these guys seem like cool dudes and I want them to succeed. Okay, Sarah, you have a player we should be focusing on more. Former, let's say, post-hype prospect.
Yes. So I have Ahmed Rosario, who is a shortstop slash outfielder right now, slash center fielder for the Indians. Of course, he was a former top prospect for the Mets, and he was traded over to the Indians in January in the trade that sent Carlos Carrasco and Francisco Lindor to the Mets. So it was him, Andrés Giménez, who was another shortstop prospect for the Mets who played a lot of shortstop for them last year, and then prospects Isaiah Green and Josh Wolf. And Rosario is having quietly a really good season for the Indians. And it feels like, you know, this isn't necessarily the top prospect that he was expected to be. He was the number 5 prospect according to MLB Pipeline entering the 2017 season. That's the year he ended up debuting on August 1st. And I think he may have even been higher at the midseason re-rank right before he debuted there. And he never quite lived up to the expectations. A lot of what the hype about him was when he was a prospect involved his defense, which until maybe the last year or so of his time with the Mets was not quite there. There was a lot of discussion when he was on the Mets about whether he might get moved to the outfield. The Mets never did it, but the Indians had him there, I believe, on opening day. But he is hitting .290 this year. He's slugging .428, which is nothing to write home about, but it is pretty notable for him, a guy who slugged .371 last year and .394 in that call-up year in 2017. And he just had a crazy game last night. So I was sitting here and trying to decide who I was going to talk about. And Ahmed Rosario, I'm good friends with our Indians beat reporter, Mandy Bell. And she'll often come to me with research questions, trying to figure out how notable something is. And I will say I've gotten more Ahmed Rosario questions this year than I ever would have expected when he was traded to the Indians. And it's because of things he's been doing. I mean, we know he has a speed. He is in the, I believe, 99th percentile, 98th percentile in sprint speed. But last night, he went 5 for 5 with 5 RBI. He had 2 home runs. One was an inside the park home run. One was a normal over the fence home run, as we might say. And he was just the 5th shortstop in Indians history to have at least a 4-hit game with 5 or more RBIs. So he did it as Drubal Cabrera did it. Frank Duffy did it twice and Joe Sewell did it once. That was interesting to me because this was something Francisco Lindor did not do with the Indians. Obviously, we know he was an outstanding player for them in the beginning of his career. And Ahmed Rosario has 5 4-hit games this year. I know he had 5 last night, but the 4-hit games, he has 5 4-hit games, which is the most in the majors. And I know hits and batting average, whatever, but this is kind of what he was supposed to be. One of these shortstops who's going to hit around 300-ish and maybe play some good defense. And now he's kind of also playing center field. But, you know, it's really exciting to see a guy who was hyped up like this finally start to live up to that potential. And I'm just really happy for him. I mean, he seemed to be having the time of his life during the game in Williamsport last week. I mean, you could just see in the dugout having fun with Framil Reyes and his other teammates, everything else. So I enjoy seeing Ahmed Rosario succeed. So he is my guy.
Yes, great choice. I'm huge into the Ahmed Rosario facts. He is someone he's had kind of a really up and down career, and he was really good in the second half of 2019, and he was only 23, and I was kind of all in. I'm like, okay, this is it. He's figuring it out. And then last year, you know, it was a mess, but it was really a mess for all of us. And I remember watching the games last year for the Mets, and he sort of got overtaken by Andrés Giménez, who came up, and everybody in New York loved Andrés Giménez. You know, he did the little things right. And I didn't really like see the underlying stats that said he was going to be a great hitter. But, you know, he had taken over shortstop from Rosario. And then hilariously, they both get traded together to Cleveland in the Lindor trade. And if you look at what's happened over the course of the season, Giménez hasn't done very much. And you're right. Like, they tried to put in Rosario in center field and it did not work well. I remember some real ugly clips from the first week of the season. And I don't think he's actually played there since May. And if you look at the middle infield now, Rosario is playing shortstop and Giménez is playing second, and also Ernie Clement. But it's really funny to see that they're sharing the middle infield, but it's Rosario at short when everybody on earth thought it would be the exact opposite. So I'm with you on that. I think he's got a lot of post-hype breakout potential to hit. All right. Each week, we like to finish off our show with a rant and a rave. You may have noticed we've each gotten through this entire show without bringing up Javi Baez and Lindor and the thumbs down thing, which I just personally think the whole thing was so stupid. Like, everybody was wrong except for the fans. Okay. Baez should not have been saying these things, especially for a guy who came over and then the team tanked. And I don't think the team should have put out that statement they put out, which just made everything worse. And I know it's New York and it just got so blown out of proportion. And the whole thing was stupid. There's an extra stupid part about it that I'm going to rant about at first. But I did want to briefly call out part of the beauty of baseball. So for like 3 straight days, this is all anybody could talk about. And it was just like the dumbest thing. And then the other day, I guess it was just yesterday, wasn't it? First game of the doubleheader. They come back from being down late. And Javi Baez scores the winning run. And I don't know if you got to hear Gary Cohen's call of this. It was my favorite thing. So we've got a little clip of it here. Let's take a quick break and listen to Gary Cohen talking about Javi Baez and the winning run and thumbs.
Alonso, the tying run at third. Baez, the winning run at first. 2 out. And Conforto slashes one the other way. Base hit! That ties the game! Alonso in! Baez digging for third. It's kicked by Alfaro. Here comes Baez trying to score! He scores! And the Mets win it! Thumbs around! Javi Baez races home with a winning run, and the Mets win it 6-5.
So good, so good. I mean, that's like one of the best, you know, broadcast booths in baseball. Quick postscript to that: in the post-game celebration, Baez lost his—I don't know if it was an earring or a necklace, but it was some sort of diamond—and Sandy Alderson, of all people, was helping to try to find it. which was super funny. None of this is my rant, by the way. This is all just preface to my rant. Here is my actual rant. With, like, the thunderstorm of all this happening, I saw a lot of takes that said, you know, this is really, it's a bad look for Baez, and it's really going to hurt him heading into free agency, because it doesn't make him look like a good teammate. And I thought to myself, you know what? I don't agree with that at all. Maybe it hurts him with the Mets if they were considering bringing him back. Fine. I don't know. But I don't think other teams care about this. This is like a stupid nothing thing outside of Queens. But what's going to happen is I do think Baez is going to have a tough time in free agency this year. There was a report that before 2020, he had turned down like a pretty sizable contract for the Cubs, north of $100 million. And I think what's going to happen this winter is he's going to have a tough time because his last 2 years just haven't been very good. You know, he is striking out this year 36% of the time. Last year, he struck out 32% of the time. When he was kind of having his breakout-ish years with the Cubs, you know, he was always a high strikeout guy, but he'd gotten that under control. It was like 26% of the time. If you combine 2020 and 2021, he has a .272 on base, a 34% slugging percentage. And even this year, his outstanding defensive reputation has taken a hit because the numbers aren't there for that. I'm not saying he's a bad player. I'm not saying he's a bad teammate. Like, he's absolutely someone you want on your team. But I think you combine all this with the loaded middle infield free agent market this winter, like Story, Correa, Corey Seager, Marcus Semien in there. I really do think Baez is going to have a tough time finding the deal he wants. And I'm pretty annoyed by the takes we're going to get on like January 3rd. And he's still out there saying, well, it was because of the thumbs down thing. I'm like, that's not it. It's pretty easy to see what it's going to be. It's strikeouts. It's on base. It's not thumbs. That's my rant. Sarah, I feel like you also have a Mets rant.
I do. And we're not trying to pile on the Mets. And obviously that's more a hobby bias thing than it is a Mets thing. But I write a story every month starting with May, about what it means to be in first place entering that month. I mean, it's kind of an arbitrary endpoint, but it's a nice ending of a calendar month. And when I was working on the story for what it means to be in first on September 1st, last night, I had to take a look at what the Mets did in August. So just to recap, they entered the month with a 4-game lead in the division. They were in first place. They are now 5.5 games behind the division-leading Braves, and it's not looking so great. So I just felt like that had to be historic, and that's kind of what I do. I stare at something and say, is there anything to this? And half the time, maybe more than half the time, there isn't. But in this case, there was. So I got on the phone with the Elias Sports Bureau, and I was like, how do I quantify this? Has any team ever entered a calendar month leading by 4 or more games and been this far out at the end of the month? The answer was, in the divisional era, so that's since 1969, since we've had divisions, there's only been one other team to enter a calendar month with that large of a division lead, at least 4 games, and exit that month trailing by at least 5.5. The other team to do it was the 1969 Cubs in September. They entered with a similar lead. They ended up losing that division by 8+ games to the Mets. That is the famous Miracle Mets, the Black Cat against ran across the field in a game against the Cubs. The Cubs blew this huge division lead. The Mets won the division the first year that there were divisions. They end up getting to the playoffs and defeating the mighty Orioles in the World Series. It was really crazy to me that the only other time this happened, the Mets were on the receiving end of it. It just seems like we've seen plenty of collapses, and there are some other ones if we expand it to like trailing by 4 games at the end of the month, but the only other team to trail by this many games in the standings after leading by 4 games entering the month was the 1969 Cubs, and it was at the end of the season. It was entering September and leaving September and being sent home and not being in the playoffs. So I just thought that was a crazy piece of history. And of course, we don't need to do it even with the historic parts. I mean, I'm staring at the Mets playoff odds right now. They are 5.7%. There is a steep drop off if you ever look at playoff odds on Fangraphs, which I do frequently. You get some nice graphs. They're color-coded and everything. And the Mets on July 31st, it was 71.6% chance to make the playoffs. It had been pretty much around there or a little bit higher for the entire season. And now we are down They're down to 5.7%.
We sure know how to leave the Mets fans with good vibes, don't we?
Sorry, Mets fans.
Fortunately for us, our favorite Mets fan, Matt Myers, is probably on a beach right now and maybe won't get this far in the podcast, but he'll be back next week. That'll do it for this week's show. Don't miss an episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Thank you to Sarah Langs for joining us. Thank you to Ryan Wallerson for producing. We'll see you next week.